everybody. Welcome to Magical Baddies, the realest podcast on all things mystical, magical, and spiritual. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Leah.
And we're your hosts.
Yay.
Okay.
I'm so excited for today.
I know. Part two. Okay. So if you missed the last episode, I would highly recommend you check it out because it's going to inform this one. So this is part two of decoloniality, which is Leah's jam. This is her thing. This is what she has dedicated her life to. And I think this is a really great subject for everybody, honestly, to understand what is being put out there and how this actually applies to ourselves, it applies to our reality. And I also think it will inform in some way. I mean, it's kind of the baseline of everything, but it informs many episodes to come. So not that everything is decolonial, but I think you start to see things from that lens the more you listen to Leah speak. But before we get into it, I definitely want to give a huge thank you to all everybody who has downloaded, who has DM'd us, tagged us, shared our episodes. It is like mind blowing how many listeners and people we have reached. And I'm really excited because this is something I'm really loving doing. And I think Leah and I talk about it probably half of our conversations.
Yeah.
But it's really excited to share information and to also feel like we're a part of a community. So, you know, if you are enjoying this, we just ask, continue to share and, you know, leave us 5 stars, leave us a comment under any of the podcasts or support us on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/divinevoidsophia. If you follow us on Instagram, it's also in our link tree. I'm at Divine Void Sophia. Leah's at Crystals of Altamira. And, you know, listen, it's one life to live. And we love doing this and continue to support us doing what we love. Because even though you hear us talk about anti-capitalism a lot, we also got to get that shmoney. So also... Tag Sargento, because we are dying to be sponsored. But anyhow, let's not wait 40 minutes to get into it. Let's like actually get into it.
Okay, sounds good.
So in the last episode, we gave an introduction about the difference of, honestly, like what we see on Instagram about decoloniality and decolonizing. And I'm going to let Leah lead off. Kind of jumping off that last episode to informing us the difference between the two.
Yeah, I listened back to the last episode. I really loved it. It was fun. And I realized we didn't really talk about, so what do these things mean? If people are using them, these terms, I'm putting quotes around, incorrectly, then what is the correct way? First, I would throw out correct and incorrect. Let's just throw that out. I don't even know why I brought that up. But what I have read and what I have come to understand based on my experience working not just in academia around this stuff, but in various like community spaces and indigenous spaces, activist spaces, as well as in this like academic world, there is a distinction between decolonize and decoloniality. When I'm teaching students, I like to give this distinction. And of course, every person has their own free will agency to decide what definition works for them. But the way I understand it is decolonize refers specifically to land back movements. Decolonizing for most people who are doing land back work, meaning they are working actively to have the land that was stolen from Indigenous people returned to those people. That is the act of decolonizing. And there's a critique of when we start to take that word and we apply it to things like decolonize your mind, decolonize your diet, decolonize your spirituality, that you water down the land back movements. You water down that activism. You start to kind of like take the potency away from the real material work that people are doing to rematriate land. So then what can we talk about? Because decolonizing your mind, decolonizing your diet, that's real. Those are real. They're real concepts there. So like, what word can we use? And that's why I use the word decoloniality. Decoloniality. I mean, I haven't even really explained. I feel like you have to explain three different, you have to explain five different terms, like colonization, colonialism, and coloniality, and then decolonization and decoloniality. So colonialism is kind of like the philosophical framework, the economic relationship that, you know, entailed all of these values and concepts and practices from the modernist era, from the Age of Enlightenment, from roughly 1400 to like 1600, where we saw the development of science, of philosophy, of art in Western Europe. That cultural movement was very, very instrumental in creating the philosophical framework that, you know, brought colonialism into being. It isn't that colonization didn't happen before. It did happen before, but it happened in a very distinct, different modernist way when in the work that I'm talking about, stretching back to like around the 1500s. So when I talk about colonialism, I'm talking about that era of colonialism, not like, I'm not going to talk about like how the Aztecs, you know, or the Mexica like colonized other smaller indigenous groups in Mexico, or how the Egyptians colonized other smaller indigenous groups in their area. I want to talk specifically about the modernist movement toward colonialism. That's where my interest is, at least as a researcher. So we have this movement of, you know, culture, art, philosophy. We have really famous scientists and philosophers like René Descartes putting forth concepts about like the separation of the mind and the body. We call that Cartesian dualism, like the mind-body split, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. These concepts kind of gave rise to a way of being or an ontology that made Western Europeans think they were separate from nature. Mm-hmm. And if you're separate from nature, then the people who exist in the world that don't appear to be human beings in the way that you're a human being are now free to be colonized by you as a Western European, because you don't even see them as a person, you see them as nature. And because I'm separate from nature, I can take it. I can do whatever I want to nature.
Right.
So colonialism comes from that era. Colonization refers to the physical act of going into a land and seizing it by force. It entails the genocide, the, you know, erasure of culture, the land theft. It's the physical acts that happen. And we have in the United States a long, long history of this that started with actual land taking, moved on to like actual genocide of indigenous people, erasure of culture through boarding schools, trying to take the remaining, you know, what the colonizers believed were the remaining generations of indigenous people, and erase indigenous culture by indoctrinating them into Western school systems, which was an incredible violence. And then we have this, so like, we have this like long-term impact that happens when we live in a culture of colonization for hundreds of years. What happens to our bodies and to our ways of being, to our concepts of relationships when we've been living in a colonized place for hundreds of years? That's where my research is, that's where my interest is, and that's what we call coloniality. Coloniality is the impact that it has on our ontology, the way we see reality, what we think is possible. And I have a little quote here. Can I share this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me if I'm dragging on and this is boring.
No.
I mean, we chose.
I mean, you're talking about history, which is like, you know, I'm enjoying this because okay. I can see it, but I'm listening.
It's not the, It's not like a fun party topic, I will say that. So this
well,
is from
whose party are we at? Because
yeah, I know, right? Because at our party
at
is
our
all
party.
History all day. It's a critical theory party. Okay, so this is from Maldonado, Nelson Maldonado Torres, who wrote On the Coloniality of Being in 2007. And he says, coloniality is different from colonialism. Colonialism denotes a political and economic relationship in which the sovereignty of a nation or a people rests on the power of another nation, which makes such a nation an empire. Coloniality instead refers to long-standing patterns of power that emerged as a result of colonialism, but that define culture, labor, intersubjective relations, and knowledge production well beyond the strict limits of colonial administrations. Thus, coloniality survives colonialism. It is maintained alive in books, in the criteria for academic performance, in cultural patterns, in common sense, in the self-image of peoples, in aspirations of self, and so many other aspects of our modern experience. In a way, as modern subjects, we breathe coloniality all the time and every day. So coloniality of being is really like, that's my shit. Like, that is what I love to study and read about. And that entails all of those ideas of decolonize your mind, decolonize, like, those are requests for people to look at how colonialism has impacted their beings. And that's really fascinating to me. We don't even understand. I think a lot of the people who are like talking about decolonize this and that all the time on Instagram or whatever, they're talking about really like obvious ways that colonialism has like impacted them. Mm-hmm. They don't even understand the depth of how they are still performing coloniality, even yeah. in their attempts.
So what you're saying is like, you've been on this since the EP and they're just talking about the album that made the charts.
Yeah.
Now, I think like two, because that was a lot of stuff to follow. And for me, this is stuff I love. But for the listeners out there that, you know, this is a heavy topic and it can be a scary topic for some people. Let's like make I'd like to make an analogy here. So what you're saying is decolonize is essentially, or colonization is like, let's take Vietnam for example, right? And the colonization of Vietnam by France. So that's colonizing, right? Or the destruct of it would be decolonizing. So obviously France went into Vietnam, colonized at the time Indochine, and decoloniality would be once France left, but the withstanding change, the shift in the way people think, the way people look, the way people have relationships with each other. Like, now we're not bartering and trading. Now it's commerce. Now now we're looking at skin tone because skin tone has a lot to do with whether or not you were working inside or outside. Now, you know, we eat sandwiches and this baguettes. Is now part of our national food. I mean, listen, I'm not going to decolonize the baguettes.
I'm not mad at a bun.
But, you know, also now Vietnamese food is OG Asian fusion, right? So, that's an oversimplification, but I think that might be an easy and digestible way of explaining it. You know, how people, you know, went from markets to Saigon is, or I guess it's Ho Chi Minh City anymore. My family's from the South, so it's not. It's, you know, the Paris of Asia, you know, so there's shifts in the way they exchange with each other, look at each other, and even eat, even speak, even think. Yeah. So this is what we're talking about, decoloniality. It's not necessarily like France is gone, so they don't need the land back, you know, quote unquote, but it's the effects of it, right? Would that be a good analogy?
Yeah, exactly. It's the way that we perpetuate the colonizer culture in our ways of being. And I want to say two things that are coming to me right now. So one, you're talking about a decolonized place in that the colonizing force was exited from the country. Mm-hmm. In the United States, that has not happened. So right. we are what's called a settler colonial empire, whatever, mm-hmm. Meaning that they came and they didn't just want to take the resources and bounce, or take the resources and ship them back to the country of origin. They wanted the land and they wanted to remain on the land. And in right. order to do that, they had to erase culture, kill people, etc. The other thing that you're talking about, or something that is coming to me, is like, it took me a while to understand this, but a very cool thing that happens among people is cultures get shared when you have mm-hmm. to interact with other cultures. And sharing culture and the way that, you know, diasporic cultures evolve and the things that come out of that is such a beautiful, beautiful thing. So like, it's to have like a sandwich on a baguette is very cool, but to, you know, destroy indigenous economies in mm-hmm. favor of extracting resources and imposing like a capitalist economy, and then killing people that don't
fall in line,
that's not okay. That's colonization. Right. So we can see, you know, as a person from the US, we can see, you know, things. Somebody from I have a friend who is not from this country, and he asked me like, what's American food? And I was like a burger, or like, and they're like, no, that came from Europe. And I was like, pizza? Okay, obviously not pizza. Like, we just like went down the list, and it was like, oh, like cultures blended for us to exist here today. Mm-hmm. So that's not the part that I am harping on, or not harping on, but like critical of. That's not what we're studying.
Right.
What we're studying is the way that the respect for life has been destroyed in an attempt to take land and people by force.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what Maldonado Torres is talking about is like all of the things that we don't even realize we're doing. So the people who are, this is going to be maybe a little inflammatory. If you go on Instagram and you tell everyone, you are a colonizer, you need to decolonize this and that, and your message is very shaming, well, shame, you know, Leanne Beth Simpson, an Indigenous scholar in Canada, says shame is a tool of the colonizer to control our bodies. And she's speaking to Indigenous people, but that's a strategy of colonialism to control populations, to use mm-hmm. shame. So that's how I'm not blaming the person that goes and rants on Instagram, because
we're just colonialism, shit-talking them.
Yeah. Colonialism it brings forth a pain in your body. You know, like we're frustrated. It's painful, and it's a legacy of pain. And so the only strategy we have available to us is the one that we've always known, which is to shame people. Then we're going to use it. I'm interested in how can we invoke other ways of being together that aren't perpetually invoking the same strategies as colonialism. So some of the ways that, like, I made this post on Instagram, and I'll repost it when this comes out. And it's called Inconspicuous Ways We Perform Coloniality. And so some of them include, like, if you're competitive in school, mm-hmm. if that's where you derive your worth, if you believe in linear time, if you, which who doesn't, if you, let's see, I just pulled it up. So the being superlative, being the best, the most, purity, the concept of purity is very colonial, and also very like church-based too. But like this idea of like, this is what my ancestors did, and I'm reclaiming it, and this is the only way to be. And you're kind of creating this like idealist version of a pure way of being. And that in and of itself, purity in and of itself, is one of the ways that, you know, in our country, you know, if you can't show your pure lineage, then you don't deserve to be here. And you won't be able to show it because we're the government, and we're going to erase all records of where you come from. So like purity is dangerous, but we also, I see a lot of activists invoking purity as a way to like show, demonstrate that they deserve to be here or they deserve to be saying this stuff.
Yeah. Could we talk about that a little more? Because yeah. I feel like that is like the big thing, that maybe like a lot of people, especially if you curate your social media around spirituality, that yeah. people get like really frozen around. Like,
yeah.
You know, I see a lot of the same thing. Like you can't practice this. This belongs to this yeah. and you should use your ancestor. You should use your own lineage. And it's interesting to me on a few levels. One, if you're American, or I mean, I don't know, generally anywhere in the world, most of us have a mixed background. And a lot of us mm-hmm. don't even know where we're actually from, because yeah. historically speaking, depending on when you come, you know, yeah. those countries didn't technically exist. So if you say, oh, my ancestors came from Russia in 1914, well, technically they could have come from the Ukraine. Like it just depends, because borders yeah. move, right? So that's one thing. The second thing yeah. is, what's the greater picture in spirituality here, right? Because, you know, in one hand, we can say, you need to practice your ancestry, whatever. But then we're also talking about past lives and who we were in past lives and how we resonate with that. And wouldn't spirit be so much bigger than that? You know, like, okay, so if I feel really yeah. drawn to, yeah. for example, like Egyptian cosmology, like, well, I'm not Egyptian. Should I just like back off of that? You know? So, yeah. I mean, there's like, I feel like it gets people in a tailspin yeah. and it makes people like trigger shy. And yeah. I say that because I think that there is a level of respect and reverence that you can have when practicing other practices that maybe yeah. are outside of your race line,
yeah,
or anything that's not been passed down. I mean,
yeah.
some of this is like, what did your ancestors pass down? Well, some people that's really, some people just don't have families.
Yeah.
So how does that work? You know, and yeah. and it really fires me up, because I do have a lot of clients that get really scared of even trying to connect to what their soul is calling yeah. towards. Yeah. And I feel like it makes us miss out on the best pieces of each other. So yeah. at the same time, going back to what you were saying, like this melting pot, the sharing ideas, like the one of the best piece advice I've ever gotten in my life is that information is the highest currency that we exchange. And I yeah. believe it. Yeah. So, you know, I think that if something resonates with you, if something, it makes you think, if something gives you an aha moment, why yeah. would you reject it based off of some like idea of I'm not allowed to, yeah. you know, and
yeah,
this whole like decolonize XYZ, you're right. It does come down to purity, and then it kind of like it gatekeeps.
Yeah.
For sure.
Those are colonial strategies. Like gatekeeping is a colonial strategy. Purity is a colonial strategy. And also like what you're talking about. So this is why I can't talk about decoloniality without talking about ontology. Mm-hmm. Ontology is the study of what counts as reality. What is reality? In the colonial or modernist ontology, where we believe that everything is a commodity, everything is a resource that can be extracted, owned, sold, etc., we take that concept and we apply it to non-tangible things like practices, beliefs. I read a thing that said, it was by a person from India, and it was, she's a culinary writer. And she said basically that like white people cannot use turmeric, because turmeric, like there's like a big movement of like turmeric is a superfood, and white people are, you know, it's come into mainstream American culture that like people are discovering the powers of turmeric. And her thing was, well, we in India have been using turmeric for thousands of years, and we know this already. And now that you've discovered its value, whereas before you would maybe, you know, destroy our turmeric crops or shun us for this, the use of this, or degrade our food that has it, now you see value in it. So now you want to participate. A few things are happening there. One, I understand the heart of that sentiment. For all of these years, you have erased what has been valuable to us and destroyed it. And that is painful. But then, because I grew up in colonialism, the only thing I know is colonial ontology. So my response is to turn around and use the same kind of exclusionary tactics that colonialism uses to respond to this. And that's where we get the concept of appropriation and misappropriation. Appropriation is like taking something for one's personal use, usually against someone's...
Dogs, mailman time.
Oh, I don't even hear anything.
Oh, good.
I don't hear anything.
I'm just announcing to all the listeners and viewers that the mail is here and the dogs are barking.
You mean the devil for dogs.
The devil. Devil is a liar.
I don't hear anything.
Okay, great. Perfect.
Where was it? Oh, appropriation turmeric. Turmeric. Appropriation is taking something for one's personal use, usually against the will of the person or group that you're taking it from. Well, when appropriation is a concept that comes from within colonialism. I'm going to try and highlight this by giving like an anecdote. Like, so my aunt she's indigenous. She's from the Chumash tribal nation. I don't know if they call themselves a tribal nation, but she is Chumash, which is the indigenous group that lives in the central coast of California. And I was in school. My school is on a Chumash territory. And so there are indigenous elders that also teach in our university. And one of them came to guest teach my indigenous psychology class. And he started talking about this man. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that's my aunt's dad, because he was a very celebrated shaman and a teacher, like celebrated in the way that he would like travel all over the world to teach. And I went up to him and I was like, I know him. That's my aunt's dad. And he looked at me immediately and he gave me a hug and he was like, "Your family." And, you know, I'm not accustomed to that, because I grew up, you know, pretty much in a white home where we don't just tell anybody their family. But I was like, thank you. And so later in the class, one of my classmates asked about white sage, and they were like, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about, you know, non-Indigenous people over harvesting white sage, and like they sell it on, you know, UrbanOutfitters.com, and like there's this whole movement to like use white sage, but people aren't using it correctly. What do you think about that? And his only response was, "Did anyone ask white sage?" Meaning, you're coming from an ontology where you don't believe this plant has agency or a spirit. It is not, like, basically you've rendered it powerless.
Right.
And that you have to make all of the decisions for it. You see yourself as some kind of guardian steward that is not actually in relationship with it. You're just being an owner of it when you ask that question. Our ontology, the indigenous ontology, believes that white sage is a spirit, and it has its own almost decision-making capacities, just like you do. And did anyone ask what white sage wants? Do you think that if white sage didn't want to be in those spaces, it would let itself? So I'm not saying which one is right or wrong. What I'm saying is, like, these are two different realities that are in conflict with each other. And while my classmate was really coming from a good place and a good heart of like, I want to defend indigenous practices, I don't want to overharvest, I don't want to be a part of this, I want to be critical of it, I want to raise awareness, they were also coming from a colonial place because that's where we're raised. That's what we know. So how can I not have compassion for that? But also we have to raise like a critical awareness of like, how are we being colonial even when we are standing up against coloniality or colonialism? Right.
So do you think that in the realm of decoloniality and decolonizing, do you think the policing of concepts and thoughts and processes scare people away from this idea of decoloniality?
Yes, I'm scared of any kind of policing.
I hate cops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I don't, all cops, trained all or not. Cops,
yeah. The system, the individuals, I mean, whatever. I'm an Akashic reader, so I will fall in love with anybody. But who wants to be policed? Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be policed. And so when we invoke policing as a strategy to get someone to come to our side, are we trying to get them to come to our side, or are we trying to control nature? Are we trying to like control the uncontrollable? So one thing about, I define decolonize as like this mm-hmm. land back thing. I didn't define decoloniality. Decoloniality almost defies definition. It's the kind of thing, it's like when you look at I don't know if there's a name for this phenomenon, but you look at a star that's really far away. And if you look straight on, you like can't see it. But if you look just to the side, then you can see it. It's that kind of thing. It's like, so here are some features of decoloniality. It's a lens. It's not a practice. So there is no prescribed steps. It's a lens through which you see the world. Mm-hmm. The second is that it has to be local to the place where you are. I can't speak for the entire United States what decoloniality would look like for everyone everywhere. I don't know what the issue, like this, like when all of the water activists and water defenders were going to the Dakotas, you had to go there to know what was happening. You have to talk to the people. It does not serve to sit back in scrolling on your phone to be like, oh, they should do da 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 da. You have to be in the space. You have to be in relationship with the land and the people that live there to know what steps could be taken. Decoloniality does not equal indigenous. So when I'm talking about even though that's maybe a big part of it for certain regions or certain movements, it doesn't equal indigenous. It's not the same. And it really, the last thing that I always like think about and teach people is that like, it requires an imagination. So when you get to the limit of your imagination for what you think should happen in a situation, you have to stretch past that, because that means you've gotten to like the ceiling in coloniality. You've gotten to the colonial limit, and you have to think of other ways of being. So like maybe the first thing in your consciousness journey is you recognize, oh my goodness, we live in a colonial state. I see this in the way that, you know, like in LA, this used to be an indigenous place. This is the land of the Tongva. They had lived near the ocean, like on the shores of West LA, what is now West LA, for a very long time. That's prime property for commerce, boats, ships, shipping, etc. Push them back. Mm-hmm. They have no place to live. They don't have a reservation. This is an injustice. So now, what can I do other than the only things I've ever been taught to do, which is maybe call it out. Maybe it's policing. Maybe it's shaming. Maybe it's, these are the strategies. These are, you know, to cite Audre Lorde, these are the master's tools that built the master's house. That's all I know. And so decoloniality to me asks us to like imagine other ways. And that's really scary, because a big part of like, in the US at least, I think a big part of like what our colonial government has done is that it's created an insider outsider situation. And if you are outside the box in the US, like if you are an undocumented person, if you have felonies, if you, you know, like if you are anything outside of the norm of like the American dream, then you are probably going to fight your way to be within it. You're going to want success. You're going to want to demonstrate that you're good. You're going to want to all these things. So it's scary to imagine other ways of being, because then you risk distancing yourself from like the group that you wish to be, to belong to, the, to be a part of, which is like society. So I don't know, for me, decoloniality is a loving process. And I don't mean like, oh, I want to make you feel good kind of love. I mean, it's if we understand love to be a respect for the dignity of life, then it is a loving process. It has to include that compassion for me. And that's not going to be true for every scholar or every activist in this work.
So I feel like if we are trying to differentiate the two, right? Like decolonizing feels like a group effort, right? Like, and we do hear things like you were saying, like decolonize your mind, decolonize your spiritual practice, decolonize your diet. But it's land back, right? It's for, I think, the true amount of us. Well, I mean, it, you know, the reality is those concepts are very far-fetched for a lot of people. But in decoloniality, how do we put this into practice at an individual level? Like, can you explain that lens? Because I feel like, you know, and knowing you, it's obvious to me why you're an Akashic reader and you're also into decoloniality. And I feel like even though I didn't have the language to articulate it, you know, you and I agree on a lot of things, and I just don't have the information or didn't have the information for it. So can you explain to people like what is looking through this lens look like?
I can only speak for me, but for me, I had to really study what modernism did to us. I had to, because what we're doing in coloniality is we're perpetuating the modernist values. So in modernism, that's when we learned to, we validate some knowledge systems and not others. So that's why it means more to go to a Western medical doctor who's been trained in Western medicine, than to go to like a folk medicine practitioner or a shaman or curandero. We don't value that as real. Like, it's why, you know, we quantify everything. We scientize everything. Everything of value is going to be measured in some way, because those are values that arose in science. You know, science in general, the way we know it today, arose in that era. This, and then, so it isn't just that science arose. It's not that science is bad. It's that the modernists then said, this is the only way to have knowledge. There are no other ways. So really, it's not about the thing itself. It's about the power dynamic that goes along with it. If you've ever felt less than because you don't have a college degree, or if you've ever demeaned someone because they didn't have a college degree, if you've, you know, like believed that someone didn't have value because of their knowledge, or, you know, I can think of like bringing like, you know, chile verde for lunch, and some, you know, one kid being like, that smells, and it did smell, but like, then everyone is like, that's weird. Your food is weird. So like, there's a power structure now behind who's in and who's out, who belongs and who doesn't. There's a standard of normalcy that I'm not meeting because I have this non-normal lunch that I brought, which is not a wrong lunch. It's not a bad lunch, but it's not the norm. So like, normalcy, scientizing, validating some knowledges and over others, this idea that we are separate from nature, that is huge. We don't even get, there are, you know, in many indigenous cultures around the world, there isn't even a word for nature because there is no such concept, because they see themselves as inherently a part of it. And so when I'm talking about nature, I'm not even talking about actual plants and stuff. I'm talking about, because we think we're separate, we think that we can control things that are out of our control. So think of all the ways for everyone out there. Think of all the ways, and I'm not even like, don't even think about nature. You like the idea of nature. Just think about the ways that you have tried to control things that are out of your control. Think about the ways that you have, like, you know, tried to control relationships or what other people will do, or, you know, in order to feel safe. So that stems from a separation that we believe is inherent. This idea that we're individuals, that, like, you know, we really, really toxically train ourselves and our children and every generation to, like, identify as your own self, you know, make your own path, carve your own way. Like, we make everything about, you know, like, for example, we start early when we go to school. You define who you will be based on, like, what your academic record is. Like, immediately you're being graded on your individual effort from, like, kindergarten. Even if you're not getting grades, you're getting assessments. Did you, your behavior assessments, participation assessments. So they're ruling you out as, like, an individual, and nothing in a report card factors in, well, this is one person in a group. Maybe there were stimuli in the group that made it difficult for this person to sit still. Maybe there were things happening relationally in their life. Maybe this kid is coming to school hungry because the family doesn't have food or money, but we're only going to look at what they are on a report card. So we're not looking at relationships. So when I, you know, in the West, in Europe, we have cogito ergo sum, the Cartesian principle of I think, therefore I am. Because I think with my mind, I am the supreme knower of all reality. I know who I am because I think. And then we have in the, like, Nguni Kosa, like, language families, this concept of Ubuntu, which is I am because of my relation. Meaning I know who I am because I know where I'm situated in my relationships. I know that I'm the daughter of this person. I'm the dweller of this land. I'm the, you know, friend of this person. I am the owner of this business, or I do this crap. Like, I know who I am because I am relational. And those are two different ontological, like, they're two different ontologies. So it's very cool to become an individual. I love being an individual. I love, like, I love clothes. That's one way that I express my individualism. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to use this word, the shadow of that, the, like, thing that is born as we double down on our individualism, the thing that is born without knowing it, is that now, because I'm an individual, I am 100% responsible for any burden that I experience, any hardship. I better figure it the fuck out. I don't have community. I'm not relational. I don't have a support system. I need to know what's wrong with me. I need to figure it out. If I have a bill, I have to pay it. If I have a debt, I have to pay it. If I was raised in a community where I didn't get enough resources and I committed a so-called crime to meet my needs, I have to bear the weight of that sentence. There isn't a relational response to the way that we are actually relational beings all the time. So yeah. Individualism is one of the values of modernism that we, like, are so like, Instagram is a great example. There are Instagram accounts for, like, agencies and collectives and businesses, but there is a huge push to be Instagram famous, to be an influencer, to be, like, known for just being myself. And here's what I think. Nobody thinks anything in a vacuum. We are all the byproduct of all of our upbringing, all of our community, all of the influence around us. Like, but that's not what we're trying to come across as in Instagram. We're trying to be like, I know best. I know this. I'm this cool. I'm this black. So, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I do it too. Hello. I get emails all the time. I'm like, dear Crystal. I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, I'm trying to survive in that too. I'm building a name too. I want followers too. And I recognize that it is also modernist and colonial. I could go on, but.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have three things I want to say. And I think I have one long thing. So I'm just going to I'm just going to speak and see where it goes. Okay. So one thing I want to point out is I think it's interesting in what you're explaining, right? Essentially, it's like what I call the formula, right? We look at, everybody does this. We look at this formula and we say, if you do A, and if I want to be A and I want to be B, or if I do A and I do B, I will get C, right? So like, if I go to college and get an education or an internship, I will get this job. If I meet somebody and we get married, I will be happy in love or have a relationship, right? So we look at things around us. Like, you know, we talk about Sierra's prayer, like how did she get, you know, Russell Wilson? So there's a formula to everything. And that is very colonial. And with that being said, we have this idea of the individual, which is also really colonial. But we're also looking at the individual to fall in line, which is like double colonial. I have a way of saying this. Hold on. But if the anti-venom here, I mean, we can't, it's not anti-venom. That's the wrong word. But if the goal is to be in relationship, how do we not fall into this group think? Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, that's like essentially what I study in my dissertation. My dissertation is how do we shift ontologies from individuality to like fixed individuality to relationality? How can we in the global North truly see ourselves as relational? And I don't think the answer is if it's this, then it's that. I think it's like, so for example, I teach this class, Living Systems. I teach this class for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that I was very moved by this 2018 IPCC report that said, look, we have 12 years before the planet is irreversibly hot. And it's at that point, there's no turning back. There's nothing we can do to impact the climate anymore. And that just spooked me. It turned something on inside of me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not an environmental activist. I don't know what the answer is there. I'm not a Greta Thunberg. I'm not like, I don't know about that stuff. But what I do know is that if people what I did think was, what if people had the concepts that I think about all the time? What could they do in their worlds? So Living Systems, in a sense, is a response to climate collapse. So that's an example to me of how, like, here's the problem, point A. Here's what colonialism would say. Point B is the tit for tat response. Like, oh, the oceans are full of plastic. Stop using straws. Well, that didn't do anything.
Right.
But what if the oceans are full of plastic? How can you come into better relationship with the land and growing food and have more of a relationship with the process of being alive so that you're not outsourcing everything to consumables that require giant, you know, amounts of plastic? Or how can we get giant companies that are the big producers of plastic to change their, you know, their production methods, whatever. So it wasn't like a one-to-one for me. So I think that I get what you're saying. Like, groupthink is scary because it's been used in colonialism to like persuade people to divest from their own agency, to yield their power.
Right. It creates like this sense of normalcy.
Yes.
What's normal, which is like what I want to dive into next. But so it's like, okay, well, if we put so much emphasis on the individual and that's colonial, but like, and we're in relationship, I just feel like, you know, what's the fine line between being in relationship with everything and also falling in the line, right?
Well, you know? I think like what you're talking about is like cult formation. Mm-hmm. So like, how do we stop being in a cult? And I'm sorry to say this, but if you're in the United States, you can't, because the United States is a cult. Mm-hmm. We're already in it. And so part of this is like, I think one of the things I list is like the idea of, in my inconspicuous ways we perform coloniality, is victimhood. Mm-hmm. So this, I'm not saying that we aren't sometimes victims of circumstances that are very traumatic and painful and bad. That's true. But when we come to over-identify as a victim, we stop seeing that we are agential beings, that we have agency in every moment, even if we've had a lot of things stripped away from us. And that, you know, sage, white sage is agential. White sage has agency, that everything has agency. And so I think like we have to be critical of like, what is the group think? What is its agenda? What does it want me to participate in? What does it want us to participate in? What is the goal here? So I mentioned in the last episode, the like, you know, hair removal culture.
Yeah,
that's a group think. That mm-hmm. is like, we're convinced to alter our bodies in favor of nothing more than a beauty standard. That's a group think. So like asking, even in that, which seems pretty benign compared to like those very serious cults where people take their lives, right. Shaving is like not, is nothing, but it's something, because now we have totally in one area of our lives yielded our, you know, self-governance, our body autonomy to an ideal so that we will be able to participate safely in society and belong here. So I don't know. That's like an ongoing question. That's like a really good question that, yeah.
Thank you. So while you were talking about normalcy, I thought, and this idea of controlling others and circumstance, I was thinking about my own personal experience that I'm going through right now. And one of the things that comes up, because I'm in the process of doing a lot of trauma work and therapy and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because obviously I can apply this concept, this lens, to my own individual psyche, right? So one of the things that I am working through and whatever, is obviously my mother, not obvious, it's not obvious to everyone, it's obvious to you, is my mother wound, right? So, you know, I was given up at a young age and, you know, my mom was kind of around, but never really, we didn't really have a relationship, right? And one thing that, you know, I'm in the process of writing, and my editor was like, why did you try with her? Like, why did you try to go back? Like, I don't understand. Because I was talking about a time when I was like 12 and I came back from Germany. I flew from Germany by myself to live with my grandmother because I was coming from a very, very abusive situation. And my grandmother was really happy to see me. And my mother, I was so excited to see my mother, but when she came, she just like walked past me and she mm-hmm. said hi, but that was like it. And it broke me, right? And so mm-hmm. we finally have a conversation at the end of the summer. And my editor's like, why did you give her a pass? Like, I don't understand. And I thought about it and I was like, you know, looking from it from a different point of view, from a higher point of view, you would say like, this woman doesn't want to take accountability for herself. Like, she has a mother and her grandmother. Like, why continue to hurt yourself over this?
Yeah.
But being in it as a child, I'm like, I just wanted my mom. But I think the overarching thing was like, I wanted a sense of normalcy, right? Like, I wanted, like, I went to school, I saw people with their moms and their dads, and their moms and dads would show up for things and whatever. And I thought if I had some relationship with my mother, some sense of normalcy, it would erase all of this pain. It would, it would erase like, what has me fucked up? What makes me stand out or like feel like an outsider, right? Yeah. And so this sense of normalcy kind of, you know, from what I see on like Mrs. Doubtfire, well, that's a really bad example, but
that is so abnormal.
That is really not normal. But that was more normal than what I thought. I thought that was normal. No, but like what I saw on TV and what I saw, like, you know, at school and whatever, you know, that was an idea that had been ingrained in me. And so against my own, what had my own survival kit, I'm going to continue to hurt myself to get into the sense of normalcy. And now as an adult, as I'm working through this, like, I'm not mad at myself for doing that. You know, like, I had empathy. I was being a child. I just wanted my mom, like, you know, I felt responsible. Like, I felt all these things. And so that comes down to the individuality thing, right? Like, I felt responsible that she didn't love me. Like, there was something wrong with me. And is that even really the truth, right? So now we can, I can separate myself from this. And this is obviously the work that I'm doing in therapy. And then also having this conversation with you, I can separate myself from this and say, like, okay, I can't control her. I couldn't control her answer. And honestly, one of the biggest things that really helped me in navigating this mother wound is I had a friend. I was like, I'm going to talk to my mom about, my mom didn't come to my wedding, my bridal shower, nothing, but she didn't even tell me. She like just didn't show up and whatever. I found out from someone else that she wasn't coming. And I was like, I'm going to talk to her, but I'm going to approach it in like a loving way. Like I'm, you know, going to tell her like I'm hurt, not mad, whatever. And my friend was like, are you prepared to hear her answer and for that answer to not be the one that you want?
Yeah.
And that shifted so much for me. And, you know, I think it started to pull me away from this idea of normalcy, this idea that I can control the situation, this idea that I'm responsible for the situation, and just like let her be her and let her exist as her and let me be me. And like, you know, what did you guys hear that?
I did hear that.
The fuck is normalcy, right? So anyways, I say all of this and I share all of this in that decoloniality, I think when we see it on the internet, when we see it in front of us, it seems like it's really big lens, this bigger thing that we have to digest. But like, I think in having just having this conversation with you now, I can see how it can apply to me on an individual level.
Yeah.
And take some of the pressure off.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally. Normalcy is one of the qualities to me of our culture that tell us that we're in a cult. There are no laws that dictate what normal should be. There are only cultural norms that control us. They control us to the point where we will kill each other if someone defies normalcy. So I think about like the amount of like Black trans women that are murdered by community members because their gender representation is not wrong, but it is an affront to maybe their, you know, hyper masculine community members that are insecure in their own gender, and they react with violence. They react with murder. So like normalcy is deadly. It is really deadly. And when I'm teaching about normalcy, I always ask people, so we go through this activity where I ask people to think about in their mind, conjure the ideal American family, not your American, but maybe like, you know, the mainstream American
white
family.
Picket fence, mom, dad, dog, 2.5. Yeah. Like, yeah.
So we go down the list and I ask the whole group, what race are they? What are their genders? What is their sexuality? What is their education level? What is their income level? Are they homeowners? Are they renters? What language do they speak? What religion are they? And then, and so like we can go into, we, all of us can answer all those questions because this is how indoctrinated we are into a vision of normal, but we can go so deeply in. So like, let's say we say, oh, they're white. Okay. They're white. But, would you say, are they Jewish? No. Are they like from the South? No. Mm-hmm. We have like a vision of the quintessential, like standard American white. So they speak English. Do they have an accent? Well, I mean, everyone has an accent, but like, what is their accent? It's standard news anchor accent. It is not a Southern drawl. It is not a New Jersey accent. It is not a Midwestern accent. It's going to be the standard news anchor accent.
Oh, is it so white people from upstate New York that are middle class and Christian? No.
I mean, yeah. So like when we ask about religion, even like, okay, they're Christian, but are they Catholic? No. They're like, you know, one of the Christian religions. So like we can take each of those categories and then we can dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper mm-hmm. to like fine tune how normal this totally fictional family is implanted in our minds. We know this. And then we measure ourselves against that constantly. So like, yes, it's deeply wounding and painful to be rejected by your first relationship, your mother. Mm-hmm. But then on top of that, you're living in a culture where you are deemed abnormal if your mother is not there raising you. And not just not there raising you, but is she working? What's her mental health like? Is she participating in, is she a classroom mother? Is she bringing cookies on your birthday? Is she, you know, like, does she have money to send when it's a field trip day? Like there's so many levels then of like what a good mother is. And did you have that? And if you didn't have that, then how, besides the pain of whatever the relationship is, it now puts you in a painful relationship with society. I don't belong here. I'm outside of normal. So to me, I'm like, well, the United States, because I'm only speaking from the United States. I don't know about living in other countries, but the United States is in and of itself a cult. And in order to participate and belong, we try our best to be normal, even in the ways that we shirk normal. Like I grew up in DIY punk community, which mm-hmm. was like an attempt to, you know, have a community outside of the mainstream or something like that. Like, I don't fit in, so here I am.
Well, here's my zine.
Exactly. Upon further reflection, I realized, wow, this is a very exclusionary community. Mm-hmm. It's very hyper masculine. It's like mm-hmm. led by men that are very like white and cis, and like, it's really just a reproduction of like these bigger mainstream values. It's not really rejecting anything except for that I am eating someone's shitty curry lentil stew they made for this potluck that we're at.
And everyone smells like onions in the summertime.
And nobody, and everyone's vegan, and I just want to go to McDonald's. But, so like, even in our ways to shirk or protest normalcy, we often just recreate it in these other ways.
Right.
It's painful. Normalcy is painful.
Yeah. It sure is. It sure is. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so I think this is a really good time to segue.
Okay.
Or not segue, but like wrap it up, B.
Okay.
Do you have any other final thoughts, insights, things that you want to share about decoloniality itself as a lens? And also, you know, to the listeners and viewers, we are going to list some resources if you guys are interested. Any final notes?
The first is that like, it's a conversation, it's not an end goal. So like, you can't be perfect at it. Like, you can't. So like, let go of that goal. Is it more dog barking?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but you know, no, what is normal? What's a normal podcast?
I don't hear anything. I just see you smiling. So I'm like, what's happening?
Guys, I'm a working mom with two dogs. I'm doing my best.
Anyways. I'm a survivor. It's the Reba song. There's that. And then because I am colonial as fuck, I'm going to promote my class, Living Systems, which is starting a new cohort next year. But that is one of the ways, you know, like we talk about this for a whole year. We talk about these concepts. So if this is something of interest to you, I would say get on my newsletter on my website, crystalsofaltamira.com. The newsletter people get priority access to register, but it fills up every year. And it's really a life changing experience. And I'm not saying that because I think it's so great. I do, but like, the curriculum itself is alive and it requires you to be in relationship with it. And a lot of people struggle at first because the things we talk about are not what we're raised with, but it makes an impact on how we see ourselves. We start to see ourselves relationally. So sign up for Living Systems and stop being a perfectionist. Those are my things.
Oh, Leah, you should take your own advice.
No.
Final read.
It's not for me. It's for all of you.
It's for all of you.
I don't need it.
Awesome. Well,
can I ask everyone, a question?
What's up?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I think that we should do an episode series on your specific magical interests and go deep into that stuff.
And what would that be?
I don't know. Like
out of the stuff
and Kabbalah and
I was gonna say like out of the stuff that I do.
Yeah. I mean like because you are in a different like realm of knowledge in esoteric stuff that I don't know about.
Yeah.
And I think we should do that.
Okay. Yeah, we can totally do that. You know, it is spooky season coming up and a lot of the stuff that I learned can be a little spooky. Although right now I am like really diving in deep to Judaic mysticism, which is like really fun. But let's do that.
That sounds fun.
The exciting part is that Leah is coming to visit me the weekend before Halloween. So I think we'll do a special episode then. Yeah. But I'm excited that we got to cover this because I love seeing you get in your bag. Like I like anybody getting in their bag, honestly.
Me too.
You're just so smart. And I think that this is going to be helpful for a lot of people that are so afraid to ask, like, what is this? Because of what they see online. And, you know, here at Magical Baddies, we're all about blowing shit up and just making sure that things that don't feel like as though is what they seem need to be questioned. And I think questioning your reality, questioning what's out there is really important.
Yes. And if something makes you feel shame, like if you're looking at something, somebody online and their messaging makes you feel shame, I would one interrogate what about this is making you feel shame. Cause maybe it is something like, oh, you need to resolve that with yourself. But two, I don't fuck with people that use shame as a tactic. It's just, I just don't. So don't be afraid to ask questions.
With that being said, like what you just said, like maybe that's something in you that you got to check. But also like maybe sometimes it has nothing to do with you.
Totally. Yeah. No, it sometimes, I mean, often it doesn't. I'm just saying that like, especially like we saw in like 2020, like white people that want to be a part of the racial justice movement, but then were totally unable to look at how they perform white supremacy, which I want to say not just white people perform, everyone does, but like if you can't look at it because it does bring you shame, it's not to say that there isn't maybe something there to look at, which but like why can we not look at it with compassion? Why can we not look at it lovingly? That's like my whole thing. So like if a thought leader or a teacher is or an activist is strategically using shame to make you feel a certain way or get you to do something or donate money or whatever, no, I don't mess with those people, and nobody here should either.
I agree.
Yeah.
So for all the baddies out there, again, shameless plug, if you're liking this, if you're enjoying this, always feel free to send us a message. We like hearing from you, but continue to share and support us on Patreon. Mm-hmm. And,
Smash that subscribe button.
Yeah.
Smash. Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. And we will see you next time.
Yay.
Bye. Bye.